This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Coming up, the U.S. Senate voted down a bill sponsored by Bernie Sanders that would have ended U.S. participation in the war against Yemen. Activists gathered in New York City to explore ways to end the U.S. government war against Black people and immigrants. And Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz explains why white American men are so committed to keeping their guns.
But first, Ajamu Baraka, the national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace, recently returned from an historic meeting of representatives of 100 countries in Caracas, Venezuela, in solidarity with the Venezuelan socialist government. Venezuela is set to hold elections in April, but the Trump administration says it won't recognize the election results as legitimate and has threatened to take military action. Baraka appeared on the popular Resistance podcast program with Kevin Zies and Dr. Margaret Flowers. He says peace-loving people should stand with Venezuela.
With the importance that Venezuela represents for all of Latin America and the emergence of resistance to neoliberalism, it's really in the interest of the U.S. to continue to undermine and to, in fact, effect regime change there if they can. So we're really concerned about that, and there are people who are concerned about that also. In terms of the regular people, the regular masses, when you look at the sectors of the population that are still voting for the party, or the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, the support is still remaining somewhat solid and consistent. We have to remember that there were elections for governor back in October, and the party won 17 of those 23 contests. And that's really a reflection of the still sustaining popular support for the process. But it also is an example of the concern that the U.S. authorities have, because, of course, they want to see the government change. And they see that as a consequence of missteps by the opposition and their own interventions and the counterproductive results of those interventions, that there's a real possibility that if there's an election for president, that Maduro will in fact win. That would then ensure that they will be in office for 6 more years. It would undermine further the opposition. It would split even more, and there will be elements of the opposition willing to cut deals, if you will, with the government to normalize the situation. So, you know, they're really concerned about the democratic possibilities of Venezuela. So the people believe that if they hang in, that they're going to be all right, even though the sanctions and the blockade, and that's what it is resulting in real pressure on the Venezuelan people. The government is attempting to try to make sure that the basic goods that people need to survive are provided. And that's why you have the government imposing these subsidized and regulated prices for basic goods. But that, of course, is driving for the more better off a black market process. So what people are referring to as rampant hunger and all of that inside the country is really a distortion. There's scarcities, but the scarcities are as a consequence of decisions being made by elements of the oligarchy to withhold products in order to not only put pressure on the government, but to get more money in the black market. So, yeah. You know, the people are enduring the long lines to get those basic products because they need it. They can't afford it otherwise. And they are, through their presence, attempting to support their process.
You mentioned that the opponents to the Maduro government have actually been losing power. And in fact, the Maduro government was negotiating some sort of a peace agreement of sorts with that opposition, which we understand was successful until the U.S. put pressure on the opposition not to sign that. Do you have hope that if the election goes forward in May and, you know, Maduro wins, that there is some possibility of the opposition and the Maduro government coming to some sort of agreement?
I think that there is, it's most certainly going to be some kind of an agreement to cooperate. They have no other choice. If the Maduro government wins, then unless there is some kind of extra legal intervention, and we know that the U.S. authorities were hoping and are still hoping that there may be elements of the Venezuelan military that might step in, which I doubt. One of the experiences we had was we went to a ceremony at a military base on the fifth anniversary of Chavez's passing. And it was almost kind of disconcerting to see military soldiers marching, and they had a part of the program where they were making these declarations. And to hear members of the military make their declaration of commitment to socialism and anti-imperialism is like, it just kind of it's kind of jarring. And you see that for the mid-level soldiers, mid-level officers, and the lower ranks, the result of 18 years of political education inside the military is paying off. Now, the weak points, of course, you still have some elements at the highest level, levels that are still there, very few of them. And interestingly enough, some of the newer recruits are a little shaky, because they're the ones that have experienced the shortages and scarcities over the last few years and subjected to intense oppositional propaganda. So there's some concerns. I have some concerns there. It is talking with a few of the lower rank military personnel. But in terms of the likelihood of intervention on the part of the military, I don't see that happening. Now, there can be the possibility of some kind of pretext. You know, there's a border dispute that's been in place for quite some time between Colombia and Guyana. And so we've seen that there's been a sort of a ratcheting up of that issue over the last months. And then, you know, of course, you have the situation with Colombia and the reports we've been getting that there's been increased troop movements of U.S. personnel at the Colombian bases that the U.S. has access to. And then you have the right-wing government in Brazil. Now, will they attempt to intervene directly militarily? A scenario for that is not clear and probably unlikely unless some kind of provocation, some kind of pretext is created, perhaps maybe with Guyana, we don't know. But there's still troubling political realignments taking place in South America with the consolidation of the more reactionary states in the so-called Lima Group. It has consolidated themselves as a opposition to Maduro and Venezuela and Alba and all of the progressive motion on the continent. Yeah. So there's still the possibility of some kind of created friction point that can allow for a direct U.S. intervention. And that's why it's so important for anti-war forces, anti-imperialist forces in the U.S. to be vigilant in our opposition to any intervention at all in that part of the world.
It's very heartening to see that more than 100 countries were represented in Caracas for the events last week. And I think in your experience with, you know, struggles around the world in your long career, how important is that international kind of solidarity and dedication to it, keeping eyes on what's happening there?
It's absolutely fundamental. And especially for those of us in the U.S. who are at the center of empire, some of the collaboration with the U.S. state vis-a-vis Venezuela has been really shameful on the part of many people who call themselves leftists or radicals or whatever. We have to avoid the arrogant position that because an experience, a project like Venezuela may not be unfolding in ways that we believe should be the correct path, which is interesting because we have not made a revolution in the U.S., but we have all these super revolutionary theorists that know exactly how you do that. We should avoid those kinds of conversations and just coalesce around the principle that we should not allow for U.S. intervention into these situations, regardless of what is happening. And we know that internally in those countries, if we can agree that our position as citizens of empire is to put a brake on empire, then I think we will be fulfilling our responsibility to the people of Venezuela and our responsibility really to the world.
What do you see happening in Syria now? It looked like things were getting under control, that Assad had survived the attacks, but it seems like the many ways the violence is also increasing. What do you see?
I see that the U.S. has no real coherent policy in Syria, except that now it's becoming to be quite obvious that the only thing that they're going to attempt to do as a fallback position is to try to maintain a physical presence in that country. But because of their lack of coherency in terms of how they see that situation unfolding and the complications of their relations with Turkey, with the Kurds that they are embedded with the pressure coming from various neocon elements in the U.S. state apparatus and foreign policy community to focus on Iran, they have not been able to, in this administration and the last administration, to really be able to identify objectively what are U.S. interests.
Yeah.
And how should those interests be realized? So there is, some people say it's planned chaos. I never have accepted that. I think that the chaos and their policies in that part of the country is a reflection of the general chaos and lack of real competency on the part of the foreign policy advisors and the divisions among the foreign policy community in the U.S. So it makes it a very dangerous situation for the people of Syria, because the fallback when you have enormous power like what the U.S. has is just to rely on military means, violence to keep the pot stirred.
What is the basis of that division? How do you see the peace movement's confusion in debates about Syria? What should the peace movement be doing in the United States?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting and very important question. I think we got caught in Syria in the same way that I was suggesting we needed to avoid for Venezuela. And that is attempting to determine to what extent we would put a brake or not put a brake on U.S. intervention based on how we saw the internal alignment of forces and the political situation inside that country. And when that becomes the basis for whether or not we're going to be anti-imperialist, then the result is that we end up objectively aligning ourselves with intervention when it's clear that the U.S. is in fact intervening to undermine or to affect a certain kind of changes in any national arena. So again, if the principle is that we have to respect national sovereignty, that we don't inject ourselves in the internal contradictions of these countries, that our responsibility is to put a brake on imperialism, then that could be the basis of us clearing up some of the confusion in terms of what should be the objective position on the part of the peace community, and in particular, the anti-imperialist community.
President Trump announced that he wants a military parade in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
We were all, you know, part of that kind of group that met last month to talk about a response to that. Do you want to talk about that military parade in the context of what's going on?
Well, you know, the military parade is interesting that it's taking place for polls right at the point where, as we said earlier, there's this national debate around issues of gun control and violence, and it shows the complete psychological disconnection between that conversation and militarism. The assumption is that everyone understands that there's a disconnect, there's no connection, and that militarism and asserting U.S. military might is something that should be supported, accepted and supported. It's important that it's clear opposition to this. I think that we have to demonstrate that there are sizable numbers in the country that are opposed to U.S. militarism. And I think this may be a misstep. I think it may be an opportunity for us to demonstrate that there is a real anti-war sentiment here in this country. We all have been part of the conversations around how we revive the anti-war movement here in this country. And we know that there was a lot of resistance to a national mobilization, for example. And so we compromised, and now we're asking people to engage in regional and local mobilizations on April 14th and 15th, which is important. In those mobilizations, we're hoping people raise the issue of this parade as part of the attempt to normalize militarism. But the fact that now we're going to mobilize in opposition to the parade, if it happens, and be in massive numbers in D.C. in November, we have our national mobilization. which I think is very important. So I think 2018 is going to be a key year for the revitalization, the reviving of an effective anti-war, pro-peace, and even anti-imperialist movement here in this country.
That was Ajamu Baraka of the Black Alliance for Peace, speaking with Kevin Zees and Dr. Margaret Flowers of Popular Resistance.
The U.S. Senate last week voted on a bill sponsored by Bernie Sanders that would have ended U.S. involvement in the Saudi Arabian-led war against Yemen. The measure was defeated 55-44, but David Swanson, the author and anti-war activist, says that's actually the closest the Senate has gotten to shutting down a war in a long time.
For the first time in history, a senator forced to vote to end a war using the War Powers Act, which has been done in the House numerous times, but never before in the Senate since 1973 when that Act was created. The U.S. is engaged in several wars. Most people I talk to around the country think the U.S. is at peace or think it's engaged in some war somewhere, but they can't remember the name of the country. And in those circumstances, with Congress just sitting back and letting all the wars roll on illegally, for the Senate, even more so than the House, to force a vote on ending one of the wars and have 44 of the senators, which, you know, in theory, I'll just need seven more, vote to end the war, or technically vote on not to table the vote to end the war, is remarkable. But you put it in context of civilized countries that don't engage in more wars than they can keep track of, and look at some of the comments where advocates for ending the war on Yemen were reassuring their colleagues that any sort of precedent where you were obliged to end any other illegal wars, it just highlights the sort of madness.
Could the presence of Donald Trump in the White House have prompted more Democrats, certainly, to take at least a kind of anti-war, this war, position?
Well, it's certainly possible. You certainly had senators, I think it was Tom Udall in particular, who argued that between World War II and the arrival of Donald Trump, the United States was a moral and noble, altruistic exporter of democracy in the world, and Donald Trump reversed all of that, which is absurd. Another senator asked whether partnering with a country that is intentionally starving millions of people to death squares with U.S. values. And I wanted to, you know, scream at C-SPAN, yes, of course it does. But, you know, 55 of his colleagues told him that as just as well as any knowledge of history could have done. I think if you look at partisanship, it's a factor. You had 45 Republicans and 10 Democrats vote for genocide. You had, yes, 38 Democrats and two independents and five Republicans, I think, vote against it. But if you look at who got more money from weapons dealers, that looks like almost as strong a determining factor as well. And when you start to talk in terms of the parties, you have to be clear that you're talking about individuals and not the parties themselves, both of which take vast amounts of money from the weapons profiteers. And one political party, the Republicans, vociferously urged their members to vote yes for more mass slaughter of human beings in Yemen, while the Democratic leadership was absolutely silent. And Chuck Schumer said not a word, waited until the pro-war votes had won, and then threw in his anti-war vote for the record. So there's a definite contrast in terms of party leadership. One is pro-war, one is absolutely silent, like the Democratic Party media, MSNBC, did not a single story. So if the vote had come close, if there was actually a chance of ending the war, of ending U.S. participation in the war, which might effectively end the war on Yemen, then, you know, Democratic votes would have been much, much harder to get, and the Democratic Party leadership would have cracked down. So you look at it and say 44, you only need seven more. At least several of those 44 are very shaky votes, cast knowing they were not voting with a majority.
And let's make it clear, this Saudi-led war is now in its third year, and Trump's participation is a continuation of Barack Obama's participation.
No question whatsoever. Barack Obama bragged about a successful drone war on Yemen, a drone war that many citizens testified before Congress was destabilizing Yemen and empowering terrorists and creating bigger disasters to come. And here they've come. And so you had senators arguing that these matters should be left to committee. Well, the relevant committees have done nothing on this for 3 years or more. And you had senators arguing the line that, to my knowledge, was first prominently promoted by Harold Coe, Obama's lawyer, has since been parroted by Trump's lawyers and is, you know, now parroted by senators, that if U.S. troops are not on the ground being shot, if you're just bombing a nation, even if you bomb it flat and there's not a sign of life left, it's neither war nor hostilities. So the War Powers Act does not apply. You know, this is an Obama creation, and it was roundly rejected as ridiculous by numerous senators, and yet other senators went with it. The War Powers Act, the Constitution, they don't apply because we're just bombing people's houses. There are no U.S. troops on the ground getting shot. Absolutely absurd. Likewise, the absurd contention put out by the Pentagon, by Mattis, two senators, and repeated by senators, that if the U.S. stopped participating in slaughtering people in Yemen, more people would die rather than fewer. Somehow Saudi Arabia, which experts say couldn't do the targeting, couldn't do the refueling, couldn't do these bombing campaigns without the U.S. military's active engagement, would manage to kill more people because the U.S. does such proper targeting of only the right victims, which the U.S., by the way, that the same Pentagon claims not to know anything about what happens when the bombs fall. So how they could kill more civilians, then what? They aren't counting them now.
This war, of course, has been devastating to the people of Yemen, but it's packaged and justified politically as a kind of proxy war against Iran.
It is. And in fact, this resolution that failed, 55-44, was only to end U.S. participation in U.S.-Saudi bombing of Houthis. And U.S. participation with Saudi Arabia in bombing anything related to ISIS would continue and be perfectly acceptable. And it's the war against the Houthis that is depicted in U.S. media and was depicted on National Public Radio that morning as poor, helpless Saudi Arabia defending itself against an Iranian surrounding Saudi Arabia and viciously attacking Saudi Arabia. This doesn't square with the facts. And it also made for a pretty hard case to sell. The thinking is always the weakest bill will have the greatest chance of passing. But you try to make a case to people that Saudi Arabia should have U.S. support in bombing certain places, but not others. And you don't make the case that Iran is not the enemy here. You don't make the case that the war is empowering ISIS, not diminishing its strength. You don't make the case against war as an institution, as something that is destabilizing, disempowering, impoverishing public and environmental needs, destroying the environment, eroding the rule of law, making the U.S. a close ally and friend of a crown prince with blood up to his shoulders who's trotting around the country taking vows as we speak. Then, in a sense, your argument becomes less persuasive. And some point we have to make the more fundamental case for actually speaking the truth about friends and about designated enemies and about war as an institution as a whole.
The U.S. is engaged in a multitude of wars, but it's not my imagination, is it? There seems to be less and less coverage of those wars by the U.S. corporate media. What's the impact of that?
Well, more and more ignorance in the U.S. public, more and more division between the peace movement and other activist campaigns, noble and righteous. So that I'm going to be here in D.C. again tomorrow with all these students to protest gun violence, and they will not mention that the U.S. Army trained their classmate to kill them in the cafeteria of their school. It's unmentionable. I go around the country and ask people about wars, and they're unaware that there are any going on. there are some great exceptions. The Poor People's Campaign is actually working well with the peace movement and understands the connections and understands the impact of militarism, the numerous impacts of militarism back home. Same could be said for Black Lives Matter and the Black Lives Matter platform. But when you look at something like the Climate March or the Women's March or the March for Our Lives, the factor they all seem to have in common is connections to the Democratic Party. There is no mention that the United States is at war at all. And you can poll the public, and the public has no idea the amount of money, the percentage of over half of their tax dollars go to wars and preparations for wars that they've never heard of, but that are endangering them and impoverishing them and destroying their environment and eroding their rights. And it's just blocked out. It's just unspeakable not to be mentioned. I'm off to a protest at the Japanese embassy here in Washington because Japan has imprisoned nonviolent activists in Okinawa protesting U.S. bases. This ought to be something that people who care about peace and justice and racism, including Japanese racism, hear about and know about and care about. It ought to matter. I read a column this week advocating for tearing down the statue of every U.S. president who owned people as slaves. Hell yes, but the same column promoted membership and service in the military as something to be proud of. Not a single one of these nations that nobody's heard of, that the United States is engaged in bombing in a major way right now, is inhabited primarily by so-called white people. And were they, it would stop. It's terrific to oppose racist killing, but most racist killing by the United States is happening outside of the United States. And people have been conditioned not only not to care, but never to hear about it, right? And the fact that somebody like Dave Grossman is marketing himself as a military killing expert and training police in Sacramento to shoot first and ask questions later and fear for their lives and treat each other as idiots if they don't shoot fast enough. And those police are shooting a black man in his grandmother's backyard who could have the telephone in his hand, and nobody's allowed to make that connection. Nobody's allowed to mention that the police want to be warriors and are getting trained by the war machine to be warriors, because that would be unpatriotic. This is what we're up against, and that's why something like that vote on Yemen, even though it didn't pass, seems like such a breakthrough.
And yes, the people of the world cannot be expected to consider the people of the United States to be innocent of crimes when they are silent.
We're not innocent, you know. We all could do more. We all could speak more loudly. It would be nice if human rights groups like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and even the ACLU that claims to care about all these symptoms of militarism would say something, and even more than the usual crowd of peace groups are saying, pass this resolution to end the greatest human tragedy currently underway on Earth, the greatest epidemic of cholera in the history of the world. Cholera, which you get by having water contain the sort of stuff that usually comes out of senators' mouths and is typically flushed down toilets. And the United Nations says that for $10 billion, $11 billion a year, you could have clean drinking water across the globe. And that's 1%, 1% of U.S. military spending. And we're up in arms about tax cuts for billionaires, as we should be. But it doesn't compare to the money that's flushed down that toilet that's allowing an epidemic of cholera and starvation to threaten the lives of millions of human beings in Yemen who don't look like us, don't talk like us, don't have our major religion. But typically people would care, and it's the militarism, it's the patriotism, it's the flag waving, it's the bipartisan silence that allows this sort of thing to go on.
That was David Swanson, publisher of the influential website War is a Crime and executive director of World Beyond War.
In New York City, activists gathered for a conference designed to bring blacks and immigrants communities together on issues of mass incarceration and mass deportation. The event was titled Breaking Down Walls and Prison Plantations, Mumia, Migrants, and Movements for Liberation. One of the speakers was Niall Fort, a PhD candidate at Princeton University and activist with the Poor People's Campaign.
Although it's not on the news every single day, police brutality is still widespread. According to one report, a black person is killed by a police officer or a vigilante every 28 hours in America. More people died from police brutality in 2017 than the total number of American soldiers were killed in action around the world. But police brutality is just the tip of the iceberg. We're also confronted, as already has already been articulated, with the crisis of mass incarceration. The United States, the so-called land of the free, currently incarcerates more human beings than any other nation in human history. You may know that we have about 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's incarcerated population. That means one out of every four inmates that are incarcerated around the world are locked up in a United States jail, prison, or juvenile detention center. That is not just a problem, but that's a crisis. So we have a police crisis. We have a prison crisis. We also have a poverty crisis. I don't know if you know, but there are about 400 billionaires in the United States. There are about 400 billionaires in the United States, and there are about 45 million people living in poverty. And as my professor, Kianga Yamada Taylor from Princeton, says, these are not parallel facts. They are intersecting facts. We have 400 billionaires in this country because we have 45 million poor people. We have 45 million poor people in this country because we have 400 billionaires. Concentrated poverty doesn't fall out of the sky. It is a consequence of concentrated wealth. Now, this is not to say anything. Now, I got some good news. I'm a black preacher, so just bear with me. I'm going to get to it. I'm going to sit down. This is not to say anything about the school-to-prison pipeline or the fact that in chocolate cities across this country, it's easier to find a gun than a job. It's not to say anything about the fact that women still, in 2018, work more for less, or the fact that we're still debating whether our transgender neighbor is actually a human being. These are dark times. The stakes are really high. And we must ask ourselves, I believe, the same question that Dr. King asked over 40 years ago, where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? But before we answer that, let me just say a brief word about King, and then I'm going to take my seat. The popular story of Dr. King is a lullaby. It's sung by the defenders of the status quo to keep us asleep. The King that I was taught growing up resembles something like Santa Claus, some kind of magical figure who came around once a year to confirm all of our illusions, our lies. But that king is far from the king of history. The king of history was an anti-imperialist, a democratic socialist, an internationalist that spoke truth to power with love and courage. He pushed for universal employment and a guaranteed income. He critiqued the war in Vietnam. He launched a poor people's campaign. And I want y'all to sign up for the new one that's happening now. The FBI called him the most dangerous man in America. By the end of his life, 72% of white people and 55% of black people in this country actually disapproved of King. King was much more than the four-word sentence that we reduced him to, I have a dream. More than a dream, King asked, what is good having the right to sit at a lunch counter if you don't have the money to afford a hamburger? More than I have a dream, King declared, why are there 40 million poor people in this country? More than I have a dream, King declared, what is happening in the United States is a part of a significant world development. King was talking about the $700 million the U.S. government fed to apartheid South Africa. He was talking about the mutilation of hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese children with napalm. But King was also talking about global revolution. Quote, these are revolutionary times, he declared. All over the globe, men and women are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. For King, the global revolution wasn't simply a matter of politics. It's what he learned in Sunday school in places like this. That all God's children matter, no matter where they are from, where they live, what they look like, or what gods that they worship. I believe that to remake this country, to remake the world, that we have to begin to tell a different kind of story, and that's why I told that story of King. And we do that, we tell that different kind of story, not merely with the words that come out of our mouths, but with the lives that we lead every single day. Where do we go from here? The first thing I believe we have to do is we have to have the courage to speak up. Somebody say, speak up. You have to have the courage to speak up. How has Zen taught us this? There is no moral neutrality in a world marked by oppression. To be silent is to be a collaborator with injustice. I'm going to say that one more time. To be silent is to be a collaborator with justice. Silence is actually violence, and it will not save you. Somebody say, speak up.
Speak Your voice can either be an instrument for justice and freedom, or it can be a tool of oppression. We have to have the courage to speak up. Dr. King said this. He said, quote, "History will have to record that the greatest tragedy of this period of social transition was not the actions of bad people, but it was the appalling silence of good people." We have a lot of good people who are not courageous enough to open their mouth and to speak up, but I'm glad I'm somewhere where we have the courage to speak up. We also have to have the courage to love each other. Now, I know this might sound a little funny talking about love, but I think it's important. We have to have the courage to love each other. Love isn't just some emotion. It isn't just something that you have between you and your boo, which is, that's important too. Okay, I tried to crack a joke out of here. It's okay. It's all right. It's all right. Love is not just something you have between you and your bae, you and your boo. Love is deeper than that. It is actually a soul force that eliminates the distance that oppression creates between us. Love is a soul force that eliminates the distance that oppression, that institutionalized racism, that immigration policies create between us. That is the love, the work of love, and that's what we have to do. We have to have the courage to love each other. Cornel West put it this way. He says, justice is what love looks like in public. So we gotta have the courage to speak up. We gotta have the courage to love each other. I got two more minutes. I'm gonna say this last point, and I'm gonna sit down. We gotta have, finally, the courage to dream. Somebody say dream.
Dream.
It's easy to become cynical. It's easy to succumb to despair. We went through the statistics. We know we have over 2 million people locked up in our prisons in this country. We know we have 45 million people in this country languishing in poverty. We know we have countless children who go to school every single morning without food on their stomach. We know we have people who have all kinds of diseases who cannot walk into a hospital and get the kind of health care that they need because we have politicians who care more about profit than people. So we can go through the statistics all day, and those statistics can wear us down. But I'm here to tell someone that we still have to have the courage to dream. I'm here today. I believe everyone is here today because there were people who came before us who had the courage not to give up, but who had the courage to have some hope. Now, hope is not some abstract category. Hope is about a willingness to struggle and risk it all for a better tomorrow. If King is right and the arc of the moral universe bends towards justice, then it only bends if people like you and I are willing to push it and willing to pull it. Somebody say dream.
Dream.
Tomorrow depends on our dreams today. And we must dream with our eyes wide open. Dream of a world where Tamir Rice can play at the park. If you don't know about Tamir Rice, just Google him after this. Dream of a world where Tamir Rice can play at the park, where Muslims can live and pray in peace, where our queer and transgender neighbors are safe to walk the streets and use the bathrooms of their choice. Dream of a world where women are not subject to more work for less pay, where Black Lives Matter, where walls are built to house the poor and not to criminalize poverty. Dream of a world where access to clean water is a fundamental human right from Flint to Standing Rock. Dream of a world where poverty is illegal, where every human being, no matter what they look like or where they're from or what gods they worship or how they love, is treated with dignity and with grace. Dream of that world. I want to conclude with one more quote from Dr. King. 40 years ago on February 6, 1968, King said in a speech entitled "A Proper Sense of Priorities," he had this to say, quote, "Cowardice asks the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it practical? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there comes a time when we must take the position that is neither safe, nor practical, nor popular, but we must take the position because it is right. I believe we fight for Vermeer because we know it's right. I believe we say Black Lives Matter because we know it's right. And no matter what happens, we have to stand together and continue to fight. Thank y'all so much."
That was Niall Fort at a conference on breaking down walls and prison plantations in New York City.
This week, we resume our conversation with historian Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. Ortiz is author of An Indigenous People's History of the United States, which looks at the establishment of the U.S. through the prism of Native American struggles, and her new book, Loaded, A Disarming History of the Second Amendment, which explores the role of white militias in waging genocide and maintaining slavery and Jim Crow.
Native Americans were also enslaved by the millions and suffer even higher rates of incarceration than blacks.
You know, this is what I was pointing out about the police forces being descendant from the slave patrols, and they're kind of automatic. It's almost like it's built into the DNA of police forces, and I think you can trace it very carefully where it comes from. And so even when they try to so-called diversify, the black cop or the native cop or whoever has to play the same by the same rules or their lives are not safe. So the incarceration is the answer. You know, it is a really another form of Jim Crow. I really think California, you know, you have to look at California as a kind of model that spread across the country of mass incarceration of African Americans, but Mexicans. And of course, the Native people are a small demographic, but in actual percentages, they actually had the highest mass incarceration. It's usually grouped around the border areas of Native nations in New Mexico, the Southwest, the Northern Plains, Minnesota, Northern California, of course, and the Northwest. So it's not so much in the general population. And most of the charges against Native people, reservation people, are federal. So they're also usually in a different system. But I think the mass incarceration of African Americans is, it's a disenfranchisement. I think it's another, it's a white republic counter-revolution of stopping the, you know, really possible revolutionary changes that the civil rights movement, along with the anti-Vietnam War movement, and it spawned so many other things, women's liberation, that this, clearly this element that is in the forefront were, you know, African Americans and the most numerous demographic. So I think that little bit in the 18th Amendment that slavery is now illegal except for imprisonment is very important, because basically the felony disenfranchises the person. They don't have the right to the Second Amendment or the right to vote, or really citizenship is withdrawn. And that is a form of slavery. I mean, in international law, incarceration that is a legal system in the United States has been criticized over and over, and the different treaties that are made that they usually refuse to adhere to for this disenfranchisement of African Americans. And you can really track the rise in incarceration of African Americans with the change in the trajectory of Democratic politics going away from a base in these movements, or at least using them as their voting base. So what we have, we suddenly see, we have this white republic back in power, and this incarceration and disenfranchisement of people who otherwise would probably be involved. I mean, they're targeted so young. I remember I was at UCLA when the Watts Rebellion happened, and just what we learned then about, and George Jackson's case, the targeting of young black men when they're like 14 and 15 so that they get for nothing, you know, for stealing a hubcap, which white kids do all the time, and they don't end up in prison for life. But this three strikes are out now. But in California, there was also chronic, so they get then a life sentence. So this is a practice with young black men, and this was spread all over the country, you know, so that it definitely takes a lot of young African men out of the labor force because they're incarcerated. And then there's a kind of industry that builds up in itself under capitalism that makes it even profitable. So it's an insidious system, and it is really, I don't know, Michelle Alexander calls it the new Jim Crow, but it's almost more like the new slavery, because it's actually under that, the right to do that, to deny the citizenship rights to a felon, is the exception to slavery that is a form of enslavement, forced incarceration. So it's no longer then a labor system, but with deindustrialization, have so much surplus labor anyway that this takes a whole lot of able-bodied working men who might become union leaders and activists or even form things like DRUM again, the Detroit Revolutionary Union movement, that powerful revolutionary movements. Fred Hampton in Chicago, working in steel industry and first organizing as a teenager. And I think what's now called the anti-carceral movement, at least here in California, is really one of the leading radical social change movements. And these strikes and all our prison strikes are really important. They have very little funding or support. It's almost all volunteer and families of prisoners. And it's a real grassroots movement. It's extremely important. But if you look at the incarceration, it really is another form of slavery and is considered such. And I think even in U.S. law, I think they're a little panicked in the government, even the conservatives, that it really has gone over the top, you know, and it's so obvious that something is not right about this. But when you think about it, how this really took off during the 1990s, the Clinton years, how the Democratic Party, this resurgence of the White Republic under Reagan, built the base for destroying the Democratic Party. You know, the Rainbow Coalition in the 80s was very aware of that. That was really the last chance for the Democratic Party to become a party of the left, and lost. You know, it was the New Democrats, the Clintons and others who came in and basically just adopted the right-wing agenda and got to work on it, incarceration and welfare.
During this same period of mass incarceration and the period in which we see the phenomenon of the mass shootings, we also see the sanctification of the Second Amendment.
Yeah, I think these white nationalist groups that have asserted themselves, starting very early with the John Birch Society, only 2 years after the desegregation decision, that these have built up to, you know, a real force, and we see them basically electing a president, and the whole Congress is controlled. So the federal government really is controlled by white nationalists, and the NRA has played an important role in that as what I consider a white nationalist group. You know, it was taken over in 1977 by a white nationalist group that formed in 1974 called the Second Amendment Foundation. This was a vicious racist who had formed the Second Amendment. So actually there had been very, very little attention paid to the Second Amendment. It was just taken for granted again until this counter-revolution. It took about 20 years by the 1970s. The NRA had become suddenly the carrier of the sacred Second Amendment. So it's all a part of that originalism of, you know, we have a Pax Supreme Court of originalists now. And that's the idea that the pure Constitution with the 10 amendments but not the others, that we have to go back and read the minds of the founders. And what, so you see all these biographies and hagiographies coming out about Alexander Hamilton. He was a slave trader for his family. He married into the Schuylers in Buffalo, and certainly no abolitionist. He's been, you know, completely romanticized. And I think all of this is, you know, culturally, it was a very right-wing thing, you know, this originalism. Bork, he was nominated by Reagan for the Supreme Court, was the first public notice of this developing originalism and the Federalist Society that formed. But it's very much how to limit the Constitution to a pre-1960 originalism, that is the founding, and then it's sanctified. The Constitution is considered a sacred document, so the Second Amendment then is this sacred thing. And even some of these young survivors in this Parkland school, in fact, most of them, preface what they say, well, I respect the Second Amendment, but, and Democrats say that. The other ones, some of them say, well, it's antiquated and it doesn't mean anything. We don't need to kill Indians anymore. They don't really say that, but they're implying that. You know, it was the frontier and we don't need it anymore. Well, obviously they do. To have a white republic, they do. They're finding it very useful. And it is what it says. It really is individual rights because the Constitution provides for the Army. The Constitution provided for the National Guard. And in the Constitution, those are called state militias under government. But these militias provided for in the Bill of Rights, which is the Bill of Individual Rights. The Constitution wasn't really about people. It was about the form of government. And so this Bill of Rights is to be able to continue, because you have to look at the main reason these founders from Virginia, slave owners, land speculators, wanted to split with Britain anyway, is that Britain had limited their settlement over the Allegheny-Appalachian chain with the Proclamation of 1763, and they'd outlawed the international slave trade. So these two pillars of settler colonialism in these colonies, slavery and taking Indian land, were stopped. They were supposed to end up just being a New Zealand, you know. And they weren't simply indemnifying what already existed that had been the practice in the colonies of these self-organized. They were very well regulated. These were not just random. They were vicious. They were violent. You know, they were killers, but so are the special forces. You know, when the Green Berets were formed, I think Kennedy was looking at, for Vietnam, he was looking at the, it was a form of those militias, you know, how to create these units that would do things that were off the record. In other words, counterinsurgency. And that's counterinsurgency that got, you know, imprinted into especially the Marines, the U.S. Marines, which were founded even before the U.S. Constitution, 1 year after the Declaration of Independence. And so I've been looking at the Marine Corps a lot and the sort of replication of these militias in a state form. But what you see popping up are the Ku Klux Klan, like I said, is a perfect example of slave patrols because they were used for dual purposes. They were used to take Indian land, but then they were used after 1670 as slavery became black slavery, defined as African, and codified, the slave codes started developing. Then this is when you see the slave patrols being carved out of these already existing militias that taking Indian land. So this dual purpose, I think, is an indicator of what we need to do now is find these strands of commonality that I notice because I cross these things as a historian and because I had a really deep interest in studying slavery and I was a teaching assistant for Ron Takaki, who was a just a young professor then at UCLA. So I really learned a lot before I turned to colonialism and land tenure, colonial land tenure, and to activism in the Native movement. To me, there were, you know, always these connections. But I think in our movements, there are these different tracks. In Native American scholarship and movements, there's little understanding of African slavery, of slavery. Several of the southern tribes actually adopted slavery and had black slaves and fought on the side of the Confederacy, those who had been relocated to Oklahoma. So we have a lot of contradictions as colonialism. What is colonialism if not, you know, using these kinds of factors? And you have, in Oklahoma, where I come from, it's kind of a distilled form of the whole country. It wasn't a state, it was Indian territory, but those five southern tribes, you know, just like slavery in general, it was an elite that had slaves. But there's then, you know, once that's the system and everyone is caught up into it, every person wants slaves, and commercial agriculture, not food production, requires labor. This is something we need to be incorporating into the history and also into a much more powerful movement. I think we tend to, in our left politics, fall into the majority rules, you know, the demographics, so that people tend to see, you know, they will admit, oh, this is very tragic what happened to Indians, but, you know, there are so few of them now, they don't count. But if we think in just in terms of numbers, like U.S. democracy does, winner take all, we're not understanding the power of Native people as the carriers of that history, who know it better than anyone else, you know, how the land was taken, still fight, you know, I mean, are still resisting and aren't going to stop. So that makes a big difference. I think we have to get out of the numbers game. Well, we kind of imitate the Democratic Party. What demographic is most important, because we're not into electoral politics on the left generally anyway. You know, we don't have to do that, but we kind of imitate that. But I think the discounting of Indians, it isn't just being inclusive. You know, it's just you leave out like a big hole in understanding what the U.S. is today and why, for instance, we have a real estate broker as president, just like our first president, the land speculator, George Washington.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host, Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.